everybody, it's Mike Jeffers, Chicago Jazz Magazine, and welcome to our feature interview for June 2019, Chicago Jazz Digital Magazine. Jim, I am so glad we finally got to sit down and talk about this. We have Jim Gallaretto, the incredible composer, arranger, saxophonist, and probably many other things that we're going to get into here. It's incredible that we get to sit down because you've like been traveling a ton. You're recording an album, which we're going to talk about first. You're playing constantly, so I'm glad we finally pinned you down. Yeah. We had got you in here to Flashpoint Academy, where we're doing all of these great feature interviews.
Glad to be here, my first time. Yeah.
So let's talk about the new recording that you're doing that's coming out on Delmark late summer.
Right.
And it's with the Metropolitan Jazz Octet. It's called D Sings Billy.
Yep.
So D. Alexander's involved in it, which is incredible.
Yeah, that's amazing.
But
yeah.
How did this whole thing come about? I mean, it sounds unbelievable, and I can't wait to hear it.
Well, I mean, it really came about from running into D at the Green Mill. She was doing something that they have annually called Toys for Tots, which John McLean leads. It's to raise money for kids and to help them, you know, with Christmas and all that that brings. And Dee was sitting in, and I think I was either sitting in or I had just finished, and then she came up on stage. And I had known of her but never really saw her in person. And she got up there, and she was I was like, I couldn't believe what I was hearing just because her voice is just amazing. And the ease and comfort and love and compassion and just, like, energy she had. So I had to talk to her. So I went up to her. I said, "Hey, Dee, I'm Jim Gallaretto, and you know, I'm with this band called the Metropolitan Jazz Octet." And she goes, "Oh, Jim, I know who you are."
Was this recently?
This was like 2 years ago.
Really?
Yeah.
You guys never worked together.
We
like,
never
all
worked
the
together.
Years?
Yes.
That's
like
insane.
It's such a big town and a small town.
Yeah.
But so she goes, "Yeah, I know who you are. I play your music all the time on my radio show." And I was like, you know, first of all, I was charmed right off the bat. I said, "Wow, thank you." And she knew about some projects I did with my string group, Jazz String Quintet, and I was like, "Wow, thanks. You know, I'd love to talk to you more about, you know." And so we connected again, and that was the year that following year we did a CD release of the Metropolitan Jazz Octet called "The Road to Your Place." It was without D, but I said, "Listen, we're doing a CD release concert at Studio 5 in Evanston. Steve Rashid has a series.
Great space,
it's a great space. So I said, "You want to come in and just like sing a number? We'll arrange something for you, whatever you want." So she said, "Yeah, absolutely." So she, we did one of her songs, and we did a song that Billie Holiday had done, and I didn't know the song. It's called "Somebody's on My Mind," and I hadn't heard it before. I looked it up and arranged that for her, and she sang with us, and it was like, it was just remarkable, just how the experience. And so from there, it snowballed into doing a project. So, yeah.
Well, I still can't believe that you hadn't played with
Dee. I know. Yeah.
I mean, it's like, wow, man. You know, I mean, especially in Chicago. I mean, for those of you that don't know the ins and outs of the Chicago jazz scene, you know, I mean, busy musicians usually don't get to play together, so I guess that makes sense.
Happens,
but you would assume that you're going to get on some gig or something.
Yeah.
So I can only imagine. So you guys, let's talk a little bit about this as an orchestra, because it's got an interesting history that we talked a little bit about off camera.
Yeah.
So why don't you talk a little bit about the history of it?
Well, the group itself started back in 1950, and it was organized by one of my teachers and mentors, Tom Hilliard. And back then, Tom had this band, and it was all the young and current professional musicians and arrangers of the time. And I think he ran the band from like the early 50s till the 80s. In 1959, he recorded an album called The Legend of Bix. It was out on the Argo label. And he was a huge Bix Beiderbecke fan. And so this tribute album sort of snowballed his interest in making this band an actual thing. And you know, it probably over the 30 years it lasted, they did a lot of interesting performances. Towards the end of Tom's life, we sort of reconnected, and he gave me this library of music. It was 150 charts.
Wow.
Stuff that had spanned for 30 years, and I was, you know, touched. And then Tom passed, and, you know, because we're all busy and it's kind of crazy being a musician and all the things we do, it sat in my basement, I'm ashamed to say, for 10 years. But in 2014, I called up some friends, two of which were also students of Tom's, Bob Sutter and John Cornegie. Bob Sutter's a pianist in MJO, and John Cornegie is a saxophonist and arranger in MJO. So I called those two guys up, we put together a band, and we started reading through over 3 years, we met like monthly reading through all these charts. Some of them were just works of art. Some of them were like, you know, tunes for to do work, to go out and do casual dates and to make money. But some of them were just like stunningly arranged. Some of them avant-garde. Some of them a lot of Bix, Beiderbecke-oriented types of arranging. And they were just, it was amazing. Just it was like going through, it was like being a jazz archaeologist, you know, being able to go through all the charts, say, hey, let's try this one. We would read it and we'd go, oh my God, wow.
Well, and for that amount of years, spanning. Yeah. So, I mean, it's almost like because his writing obviously evolved, everything evolved.
Yeah,
so from the 50s to the 80s.
Exactly.
I mean, it's like you're a historical going through his whole life.
Right.
Which
so after
be wild.
It was really, and what was funny about it is you go through and everything's handwritten.
Oh, really?
All handwritten. There was no music engraving like Finale or Sibelius. And they would do shortcuts because it was so much labor involved. Yeah. And we had to relearn what those shortcuts meant. Like you put a key signature and then not put another key signature, or there'd be some kind of weird indication about go here, go there. It was just crazy.
Yeah.
So we had to sort of decipher things. But flash forward, after reading, like just getting together for like 2 or 3 years, we decided to write our own music for this band. And the instrumentation is great. It's 3 saxophones, alto, tenor, barry, trumpet, trombone, and then rhythm section, piano, bass, drums. So we stuck with that instrumentation, the octet format, and started writing originals. And John Cornegay, as I mentioned, is a great arranger. Doug Scharf, our trumpet player in the band, is an amazing arranger as well. I do some arranging. And so we did a record in 2018 called The Road to Your Place. And that started, you know, and we're going to keep going and see where it takes us.
Well, and the octet instrumentation and size makes it manageable probably too, because you're not trying to book something with 18 pieces and you're not trying to, you know, because that makes it a lot more difficult and a lot less financially
able to happen. It's a little easier to negotiate, less moving parts. The other thing I like, though, about the small band format is it's more like chamber music. It really kind of speaks to my interest in a more intimate artistic setting.
Mm-hmm.
Big bands are great, and orchestras are great, but sometimes when you whittle it down or you distill it down to a few instruments, like 5 horns and rhythm, it's a little bit more challenging to arrange and get that full sound. But at the same time, you can also get really involved in who the players are. And it's been fascinating working with this group in that regard.
So let's talk about the new recording.
Yeah.
So you've got this group, and you've got D. Alexander.
Right.
And now you just recorded. I think you just finished, and you're going back in for 1 or 2 more sessions, and you're going to be completed out on it.
Right.
And that's going to come out late summer, and it's going to be out on Delmark.
Mm-hmm.
And they are doing some incredible stuff at Delmark. I mean, talk about just bringing all different styles and genres into Delmark now. It's really incredible. How did this come about at Delmark?
Well, I reached out to them.
Yeah.
I knew the new owners, Julia Miller and Albiel Barlari, and they were friends of mine before they wound up taking over Delmark. And I just emailed them. I said, listen, I'm doing this. I'm going to do a project with D. This was going to happen.
Yeah.
I said, are you guys interested in putting this out? And, you know, we had a conversation, we talked about it, and they liked the idea. And I'm really happy with their energy and what they're bringing to this, because they're so behind Dee and this project and making it a Billie Holiday tribute record. And we asked a lot of questions, like, you know, I wanted their input, because it was important to know that. And I also wanted Dee's input, so... It was interesting back in, I think I talked to them before the first of the year, at the end of 2018, and then we had a meeting in January, and we talked about content, about what we want to do. We want to do a Billie Holiday tribute, but we don't want to just remake it. We just don't want to just transcribe Billie's songbook and redo it. We wanted to put Dee's fingerprints on here and her interpretation, and also the band members. You know, we have some amazing soloists in the band,
and also to make it unique, because I mean, there's been a lot of Billie Holiday tributes,
yeah.
So I like that idea. I mean, you want to put your own feel on it. And this
yep.
is
Yeah.
So D, what input did D have?
We got together and I said, D, what do you want to sing?
Yeah.
Because she chose the initial song, Somebody's on My Mind. And I loved that. It was beautiful. And when I arranged that, I wanted to keep the charm of it, but I wanted to do my own thing with it harmonically. And so we went out and did some research. We spent many, hours going through the Billie Holiday discography, and it's amazing. She was in her 20s. I'm not a historian, but I think early in her career, in the mid-30s, she was recording a ton. And she was like the featured singer in a lot of these orchestras, some famous bands. And so we just went through the repertoire and said, oh, that's a nice song. Dave's like, can we do this one? I go, yeah. So we would figure out what songs we wanted to do and then how we wanted to do them.
Yeah.
In the sense of what we wanted to sound like today.
When you have that much repertoire that you're going through, I mean, you could come up with 35 tunes.
Oh, easily.
You want to do,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, so how do you whittle that down?
Well,
because you can't do 35 tunes.
You
on
can't
recording.
Do 35 tunes. The spindle set,
Yeah.
No, we just kind of figured out we wanted to make, even in the age of downloads, we wanted to make a collection of songs, an album. And so we thought, let's find out what is exciting for Dee to sing, what repertoire would lend itself of what from Dee's discography, what would lend itself to Dee and. What does she want to do with it, And you sort of figure out you're going to do some ballads.
Yeah.
You're going to do some up tunes. You're going to do some blues, influence songs. And we just kind of like came up with a list and then went with that. And we swapped things out here and there, but pretty much came up with that.
Did you do all the arranging on it, obviously, and wrote all that?
It was actually four arrangers. I did some. John Cornegie did some. Doug Scharf did some. And we also... We're lucky enough to get Tom Matta, who's at DePaul.
Okay.
He's a jazz faculty at DePaul. Amazing arranger. We got him to do one, too. So we had all original arrangements. So we were...
Wow. Yeah, what's the process? Like, how long did the concept start to the recording process?
Normally, these things can take a year.
Yeah.
We did it in 6 months. Especially when we knew Del Mark was on board... We thought, well, we want this out by August.
Right. Before the Jazz Festival.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Possibly before the Jazz Festival. So when we picked the songs and we had our conversation with Del Mark, it became apparent that John and me and Doug needed to start writing our butts off and like figure out. So we just started cramming. And I spent more time in the basement between January and April. And my family never saw me because I was down there writing and arranging.
Yeah.
And it was great. I loved doing it, but it was a little bit of pressure getting it done and then booking the band and rehearsing the band. And so we did it in record time,
yeah.
In like 6 months. So
that's supposed to come out late summer, probably, yeah. Hopefully late July, August,
right.
Somewhere
yeah.
In that ballpark, yeah. On yep. Del Mark Records.
Yeah, yeah.
And it reminded me when you were talking about being down in the basement and writing and all that. I remember we interviewed you. For the Jazz String Quintet.
Right.
And I remember we interviewed you at the Green Mill one time,
right,
before,
yeah.
One of your gigs for one of the ChicagoJazz.com videos I used to do.
Right, yeah.
And you guys were doing a performance there, and you had just, I think, come out with a new recording at that point, or you just did some arrangements and stuff.
Right.
But you reminded, because you were talking about in 1997,
mm-hmm.
when you said, sure, to somebody, yeah, oh, I've got these tunes, and then you locked yourself in the basement and started writing.
And
so you're used to being locked in the basement writing music.
Yeah,
apparently.
It's self-imposed exile from reality. And I guess I kind of, when I'm writing, it's usually... on a deadline.
Yeah.
And I'm also writing for specific people and for a specific scenario. Either it's a performance or recording. And, it's for me, it's my creative juices. When I know who I'm writing for and when it's going to be happening, I get inspired. I start to hear it in that environment, whether I'm performing at the Green Mill or if it's a concert hall. Jazz String Quintet was... back in 97 when it started, it kind of got its start from, just being asked to write for that configuration,
yeah.
String quartet and saxophone. But it wouldn't have gotten off the ground if it wasn't for some mentors and some friends like Cliff Colnett, an amazing arranger in town. I got to know him when there was a very viable and vibrant jingle scene in Chicago. And I got to work with him. I got to know him. I got to, you know, take some of his arranging courses. So he got me going with that. And so I you know, you owe everything to people who came before you and helped you out.
He's one of those guys. He teaching? Because you went to school at DePaul for music. Was that like a jazz studies kind
No. Back then they didn't have that. They didn't have it. They had a jazz band and a jazz ensembles, but no degree in jazz. But I majored in composition both undergrad at DePaul and my graduate at my master's.
So you were always interested in writing.
Always a writer, always interested in all kinds of music, whether it was classical music, love Stravinsky, still do. I mean, you know, Ellington. I mean, just it's all great. Whatever great music there is, I'm very interested in.
What do you think drew you to the compositional stuff? I mean, you know, sax, because you're originally like a sax player, right? I mean,
right.
I'm assuming you came out of high school, you're a sax player,
right.
You're playing and all that. You went to college and you got into the compositional thing and arranging and writing.
I think, you know, the thing, there's a really strong connection between improvisation and composition. They're separated by time. Improvisation, you prepare to improvise, but then you improvise spontaneously. You can do the same with composing, but you don't do it spontaneously. The writing process happens over time, but it's more gradual. You can go back and revamp things. But the connection between improvisation and composition, somehow I made that connection early on in college because I was improvising. I was playing at jazz clubs, studying jazz on my own, and when I started digging into composing, I found all these connections that made sense to me, that actually influenced my improvisation, and then my improvisational pursuits influenced my compositional pursuits. So they sort of fed and helped each other, and it's always been there for me. Matter of fact, when I have a little, you know, writer's block, you know, you can get, I'll just pick up my tenor and start coming up with ideas, and then, okay, great, I'll write those down. Oh, yeah, I like that. Let's use that. And it's just constant flow between the two.
Because you have to be naturally curious, I would imagine,
right.
Because you tell me if I'm wrong, but talking to like a Ryan Cohen or Orber Davis, they're fascinated by it, so they go back in time and they start watching and they're reading scores and learning what the masters did.
Sure.
Is that something that you did?
Oh, absolutely, without a doubt. Listening to music is the best tool, you know. I mean, obviously, looking at scores can give you insight. But now, if I'm listening to music, I can sort of imagine what it looks like on a page, and maybe even how it's organized. You know, there's a hierarchy. If you have a melody and accompaniment, and you know, how do you make an accompaniment that complements the melody? You sort of like start to see what a composer is doing and how they're mapping out their music, whether it's an orchestrational thing. So that's definitely a thing, to be able to go and look at the masters and understand, like, oh, that's why that works. Oh, this is even transcribing a solo is kind of a composition. It's an exercise in composition, depending on how you look at it. You know, if I'm transcribing, pick any saxophonist, then I tell this to my students, too. Transcribe, go in there, and then steal everything. Steal everything. If you like it, steal it. Practice it in every key. Work on it so you can call it up on an improvisation. Figure out how to use it in other keys and other chords. Just, if you like it, steal it.
Yeah.
Figure out how it can make it yours.
Well, that's the key, too, right, to music. So playing, so composition is the
same thing,
right?
Same thing,
It's just incorporating and finding your own voice
in
what you're doing.
Yeah.
So with the string quintet in 1997, that's the first time you got it together. Now, explain to everybody what the instrumentation of the string quintet is.
So the string quintet, my quintet, is string quartet, which is two violins, viola, cello, and saxophone. And the saxophone I play in that group is always soprano sax.
Okay.
And I've sort of developed my own way of style of playing soprano sax, my own development. I developed my sound to fit inside the string quartet. It's still a jazz sound, but it sort of has a little bit of a, it's hard to describe, but it blends with the strings.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, I've, you know, the first, well, in 97, I wrote this first piece, and it changed my life. You know, it had, you know, people talk about epiphanies.
Yeah.
It definitely gave me an epiphany of purpose of what I should be doing. And that was writing for strings, for this 20-year period, and then playing with strings and improv and working out the music so that I can not only write for them, but but I can improvise in that setting as well, which is, for me, fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Over the many years that I've been doing this, I've had extreme fortune of working with Kurt Elling. I had written for him. He recorded with us on our first CD. I was actually, and then we went on to work with Patricia Barber.
Mm-hmm.
She sang a couple songs on our following CD. And the most recent album I did for Jazz String Quintet is called The Pythiad. And that singer is, it was written for a singer, Cheryl Wilson. And she's sort of an unknown and an amazing singer. Some people don't know her, some people know her real well. But she also came from singing in the studios when there was a lot of commercial work in Chicago. And she's gone on to do amazing things. She's been backup, if you look her up on Wikipedia, her backup singing, it's the who's who.
It's like, yeah.
Yeah. But she's an amazing vocalist, and she and I got acquainted through where we both teach at Roosevelt University.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote kind of, you know, things, one thing leads to another when you meet somebody and you get interested in what they're doing. I usually try to write for them. And she agreed, well, yeah, sure, I'll sing whatever you want. So I thought, okay, here we go. I got to write something. What should it be?
And so you have no idea at this point.
At this point, like, no, I haven't a clue.
Because she probably can sing any style known to man.
Absolutely.
Right?
So the weird, you know, lineage of me creating this album called The Pythiad is I'm sitting downstairs going, okay, I've got to write something for sure. I want to write something for what should it be? And I thought back like 3 years ago, I'm sitting at my writing station, and I remembered like several years back I had a conversation with a friend of mine at the Getty Museum in Los Angeles. He kind of curates some of the spaces there, some of the performances. I had been out there with Patricia Barber on her record, Mythologies. And it's the whole Greek mythology tied in with Patricia's thing. And when I was there, my friend Ralph Flores said, hey, Jimmy, he calls me Jimmy. He goes, if you come out here, I'll bring you out here if you write something that we can present that ties into the museum with the Greek mythology. So I'm sitting at my writing studio, and all of a sudden I go, wait a second. Ralph said he would bring me out to L.A. if I wrote something. I go, fine, that's what I'm going to write. So then I go, now, okay, it's going to be for Cheryl. I got to write words. And I already tried doing this a year ago, and I'm horrible at writing lyrics.
That's like a whole other ball.
I tried it, and yeah. I said, nope, that's not
yeah.
me. So I sat there, and I all of a sudden a light bulb went off in my head. My son just graduated from Beloit College in creative writing. So I said, Coleman Gallaretto, would you be willing to work with me? And I want to write this piece, and I need it to be Greek mythology. I'll write, you know, so it took about 6 months to write this suite of 10 movements. And he worked with me over that time, just coming up with, I came up with some melodies. I said, you know, it's a sad character. What do you got? He said, look, you do all this research, and there's no shortage of tragedy and strange, you know, Greek characters.
Not in the Greek mythology.
But it was also fascinating. We wound up choosing some lesser known characters, but fascinating nonetheless. And it unfolded. And it was so beautiful to work with him. He was, you know, was in his mid-20s at the time and just wrote some beautiful, elegant lyrics. And I just, you know, it was a lot of work, but it came easily, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, over course of many, many months, and it was fascinating. And then we wound up going to Los Angeles and playing it there. So the happy ending, or it's all a happy ending, but the cherry on top was, I when this CD was done, I emailed my friend and said, guess what I did? And he goes, okay. And so we worked it out, and I wound up working with Cheryl. My wife and myself flew out to L.A. We wound up working with some amazing string players out there, which is, you know, that's a beautiful town for musicians. And so we did a performance that was remarkable.
When you get into that process, and this is something that I always think about, and we come back to almost the business side of it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, when you get into it, like I'm somebody, if I'm going to do something, it's going to be like, here we go, let's go,
right.
I'm getting this thing done in 2 weeks.
Right.
You can't go into these things like that, even if you wanted to, even if somebody said, I need this thing done. I mean, it's got to be a process, especially if you're thinking and you're creating something from the beginning.
Right. Yeah.
How do you think about that to get yourself like, all right, I know this is going to be a 9-month project or however, because you must set it up in your mind because you know what it takes.
Well, when I sat down to write the Pythiad, there was no real deadline in mind. I just knew I knew I could do it, keep going until I'm done.
Yeah.
With the project with Dee, there was a bit of a deadline in my mind. But to answer your question, to your point, is how do you keep going? I got to tell you, when I'm sitting in front of my writing station and I'm doing it, I could sit down and then all of a sudden I go, what time is it? And 6 hours will have gone by.
I'm not even worried about it.
I'm not even aware. So I mean, I've got the day free and I'm like, okay, I want to write today. And 6 hours will go by like that. And wow. It doesn't even register. And then I go, I got to go to bed. I get up and I set my alarm. When I'm in a writing thing, I'll get up early and get down there at 7 a.m. because I want to. I'll actually be thinking about things before I go to bed, and I'll wake up like, wait a second, that's how I'm going to do it. And I have to go down because, when the muses speak, you have to obey, because then they'll go on to somebody else. They have a long list of people they need to get to. And I go, okay, fine. And you have to I'll get that down. You write it down, even if it's just taking a note or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So now with the Jazz String Quintet, you guys are still playing and doing things, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you've done a lot of things with that group. I remember, you've done stuff at, I think, Millennium Park.
Right,
you've done
yeah.
a lot of different things with
right,
that group.
Yeah. We went to New York and did a concert with Fred Hirsch on a barge. It's called Barge Music. And if you know this place. I don't remember the woman who started this. She has since passed. But she started a chamber music concert series from buying a barge.
Just a barge on the Hudson.
Yeah. And so the barge was floating out, and then she built, wood floors, beautiful seating, and it was a whole concert series that would happen year round. And so we actually, in 2007, I got the chamber music grant, and it was like, it's a gift, but it's when you get money to do things in music, people don't realize how much it costs to get something done, like a recording, and rehearsing, and it's an amazing thing. And when I got the call that I got this grant, this award, I was like, "What? It's like you're going to give me money to do what?" Anyway, so we did that was our first CD, and I used that money to go to New York and play at this on this particular barge, and I had known Fred Hirsch from working, performing his Leaves of Grass here in Chicago at the Goodman. And I said, listen, we're coming there. Would you want to sit in with us or play with us? I'll write something for you. And he agreed. And we wound up doing this concert on barge music. And it was quite stunning.
Wow.
Yeah. And it moved in the water.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you felt it. It's like, and unfortunately, I didn't know this, but our second violinist had motion sickness.
Oh,
I didn't know it was going to move. And she goes, Jim, I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to do this. And it worked out, but it was kind of funny.
You know, it's interesting because when you get into the classical side, so the string musicians, string players, do you have to find the right ones that understand jazz and classical? Because there's that whole thing where if you're playing classical piano and then you want to switch over to a jazz piano and getting the feel,
right,
the not even the improvisational stuff,
right.
just the
no,
feel
I,
of it.
I know what you mean. The answer is yes and no. The players have to be willing to do and not do certain things to make it right. They never have to improvise. It's something I never ask my string players to do because you don't. That's not what they're trained to do.
Yeah,
and. But the things I do ask them to do occasionally, very rarely, is to swing a note. But it's almost not needed because something that Cliff taught me to do, Cliff Kolnit, is that if you write it a certain way, you just have to ask them to play what's on the page, and it'll happen the way you.
If you write it the right way.
If you write it the correct way, and a good example is Bernstein. Right now. I'm playing West Side Story with Lyric Opera.
Mm-hmm.
An amazing experience in and of itself. But getting to read what Bernstein does to make classical players swing is an education.
Ah.
And Cliff hit me to that. I learned just from playing some of Bernstein's music that, he's writing it this way so that when you listen to it, it sounds like it's doing this thing that jazz players do. But they don't know. I'm just reading the page. They're just reading the music.
Yeah.
There's some of that. There's some of that sleight of hand in my writing, mm-hmm. where I just kind of figured out, okay, if I have them do this and play that note there, it'll sound like it's swinging. You know? Or if I don't need it to swing, I'll do that. You know, so it's kind of a compromise of or trying to figure out how to get what you need from the people that are in front of you. You know, mm-hmm.
But let's talk before we finish all this up. Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about your playing, because you, outside of all the composing, all of this other stuff you have going on. You just mentioned you're playing at the Lyric Opera, so you're playing in the pit there.
Yeah.
You were touring. I think you were playing with Patricia Barber here and there.
I actually
was just in New York.
I was just in New York with her. I was there kind of to be do some sightseeing with my son, but I thought, well, let me just call up Patty. I said, here at the Birdland, right? She goes, yeah. I go, can I sit in? She goes, yeah, you can. She just put out an amazing CD called Higher, and it's out on Artist Shares, and I'm on that CD and very proud to be on it. Her writing is so inspiring. She's been getting into this writing art songs, kind of like Schubert and Schumann would write during mm-hmm. their day. And it's just beautiful music and harmonically something I could never envision, you know, by myself. Just hearing her sense of harmony and what she's doing with it is pretty unique. And I'm with her on Monday nights at the Mill, and I've been doing that for a while. And that, to me, is one of my favorite gigs, you know, just to be there with her on Monday night and to play with, you know, she has her steady bass players, Patrick Mulcahy and John Deidermeyer, mm-hmm. and those two guys with Patty. It's a great trio. And, you know, in Patty's thing, you know, her playing and singing has evolved. And, you know, just constantly, you know, creating a new way of presenting her music. It's just stunning to be around that.
Well, I had her on the feature interview in November.
That's right, yeah, right.
And hearing her talk about her concepts and everything, it just keeps evolving.
I mean,
that's her whole thought process. Yeah. She's not thinking about staying stagnant, and that's what reflects in her music.
Yeah, obviously. And it inspires me. Inspires me to sort of figure out what, you know, whenever you pick up the saxophone or you're sitting down to write, I'm kind of, part of it is maintenance, just keep everything kind of, you know, strong, but you're kind of going, well, how do I want to do this? You know, what's another new way of presenting, you know, playing on this chord change or this song or this standard?
Well, and that's true artistry, right? I mean, you're an artist, because I know you play a lot of different things, so I'm sure you played some jobbing things here or there. You do things like that, so you're not exactly taking it way outside if you're playing for a specific event.
Context is pretty much important.
Right. How did you start doing that? So when you were coming up, you talked about the jingle scene and all that. Were you in that kind of jingle scene towards the end of it?
Back in the 90s, the jingle probably had another 10 years left. It's kind of gone away for various reasons, as most industries change and evolve.
Well, Chicago had a lot of studios, I mean,
and a lot of companies.
Yeah.
So, you know, but, you know, when I was at DePaul, even though I was a composition major, I was studying classical saxophone with Bob Black, who's a great teacher, taught me everything about practicing and playing the saxophone. I studied with a jazz, kind of a local jazz legend, Joe Daly.
Oh, sure, yeah,
and
Joe Daly.
I studied with him for years. A lot of guys studied with Joe Daly.
Yeah.
And I played classical music. I played avant-garde music. I played in jazz clubs with different groups in town. Whatever was interesting to me and it would come my way, I would say, yes, let's do this.
Yeah.
You know, I played early on with Lawrence Hopgood before he became the household name now that we
understand. Right,
But, you know, and John Mulder, I played with him. I mean, I'm currently playing with Steve Million, and he's got a group called the Baker's Million.
Mm-hmm.
Andy Baker and Steve have a group. And so, I mean, just, you know, as you go through the process of being a musician and an artist, you not only figure out how to make a living, you also try to figure out how can I do that and be an artist. It's an interesting balancing act. And for some people, one is more important than the other.
Yeah.
And that's just a personal choice. I've been lucky to have options of having both and to the degree where I can make my living in music
mm-hmm.
and be an artist and try to evolve and keep my focus in making beautiful music. And, you know, I'm lucky. Not everybody, you know, can say that they're doing both and they're happy with it. I mean, that's the idea, is to be happy.
Yeah,
right?
That's the whole
and
purpose.
Just the balance. Like, if you're happy doing just this, do that. If you have to do just that, you just, you know, I like doing both. I like being, I like playing, you know, I make most of my living right now, knock on wood, in the theater, doing, you know, Broadway and Chicago productions. I play a lot of flute, a lot of clarinet, you know, just you know, and I got good at that. And so now I, you know, being employed in that way is great.
Yeah.
It allows you to be around amazing musicians, great, you know, music, and you know.
And then it also frees up your options, too, because then if you know you're doing that, then going and playing on a Monday night with Patricia Barber, or going and sitting in somewhere playing at Catch 35.
You're feeding your soul.
You want to do.
You totally have to. You know, and, you know, my wife is a freelance cellist. And so we've been doing this ever since, you know, we've been married, you know, just trying to make our way.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, with the all the different things that you're able to do.
Right.
It allows you to have all the different revenue streams that you need to be a working musician, which I don't think a lot of people, they see you up on stage and they're like, oh man, that's great. But I mean, you also teach at Roosevelt.
Right. And I tell my students, I go, you know, if you want a career in music, you have to do three things really well. Well, maybe four. Play your instrument extremely well. Play it in tune. Be able to improvise. Read chord changes. You have to be able to arrange music for any instrument that's available to you. Mm-hmm. So it means you have to study instruments and understand how they work and how to do voice leading and all that kind of stuff. And you also have to know how to teach, you know, and I do a fair amount of teaching and I love teaching, and it's always a source of, you know, inspiration for my own practicing. And you actually have to, the other thing, you have to be very organized about what you do. Because if you say yes to something, you better follow through and show up on time, you know, and I think, you know, as a teacher, I need to teach them that as well.
Sure.
You know, I didn't know that when I was in my 20s. I was like,
so do you have people that say, it seems like a lot of work, I'm going to go into the accounting department?
Some have. Yeah. Some have. And I don't begrudge them, because they see, well, you know, they can't see the path before them. And I don't, you know, I'll be honest, when I was in college in my 20s, I didn't see a path. I just was like, give me this instrument. Just give me that horn.
Yeah, I want to play. Let's go.
I just, you know, and you know, as you learn how the world works and how relationships and, you know, business, how business works, you figure out how to navigate. And there's, you know, they teach that now in schools. They teach the business of music.
Do they?
Yeah.
I think they didn't teach it when I was in school either.
No, they didn't. They didn't do it for me either. But, you know, you learn. And there's things you can't teach, too.
Right.
You just have to experience it and kind of go through it, you know, how to treat people. You know, you can't teach people.
No.
Yeah.
No.
You know, and how to be a good listener and how to, you know, just be responsible.
Yeah. But talking about business a little bit, you mentioned before we came on camera, you've got a nonprofit that you've got started so that you can kind of help, I'm assuming, fund some of these things, because this stuff is not, we're talking about the Metropolitan Jazz Orchestra and the Jazz String Quintet.
Metropolitan Jazz Octet.
I knew I was going to screw
there
up.
There's a copyright issue there.
I know, it's on the bottom, I couldn't see that far.
No, I know what you mean. The idea is that, okay, the nonprofit is called Jazz Artists Resource. And it got started kind of at the same time MJO, the Metropolitan Jazz Octet, was starting to explore the music of Tom Hilliard. I had somebody approach me and say, listen, I can figure out how to help you with this. I know people who can help you get, you know, pay the guys to rehearse.
Right.
And I said, okay. He goes, but the only thing is, it has to be something that could be written off, so it has to be nonprofit. So I figured, I quickly got connected to a company that would be a fiscal sponsor out of New York. And then so I used them for a little bit as a fiscal sponsor for nonprofits, so that whatever money comes in, that could be a tax deduction. Mm-hmm. Then I formed my own, because the fiscal sponsor was taking 10%.
Right.
So I figured, I can do this. So I just, you know, get together with a lawyer and say, fill out your paperwork. It's not that hard to do to become a nonprofit. You have another set of tax returns, but, you know, it's not that bad.
Right.
So we became a nonprofit, and we were starting to get some money from people who are interested in seeing our mission statement happen. And that mission statement, it's kind of threefold. One, to be able to present music and support jazz, whether it's writing new music, what I call curating older music, or discovering, like, there's so much music out there that has yet to be presented to anybody. And some of it's very old. Mm-hmm. You know, you could go, you know, and that's what happened with MJO. We had this music that was hadn't seen the light of day for maybe 20 years. And so, you know, we were able to do some concerts with Tom Hilliard's original library. We actually did a performance and a lecture demonstration that was about Bix, Beiderbecke. And so we did that at Roosevelt, actually.
Wow.
So, you know, part of the mission statement is to take some of this, some music that hasn't been out there, and to bring it to people, bring it to students. And the other part is to create new music, like the thing that we're doing with D. And another really important mission is to do some outreach. Now, we're actually going to be doing some work with Merritt School to work with the kids there, and, you know, on any level, on improvisation, composition,
mm-hmm.
maybe playing with them, rehearsing with them, showing how we do what we do. So between, you know, creating new music and reaching out to students, that's our mission, you know. And right now on the website, if people want to see that supported, they can look and they can actually make donations on the website too. So
what's the website?
Well, the website right now is called Jazz Artists Resource. It's a brand new
.org.
Website. .com.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So it's a brand new nonprofit. So I, you know, right now, it's so new that I'm sort of, you know, the only one dealing with it, and I'm learning as I go. It's a new thing. It's a new business thing that I, you know, every day I'm learning. Oh, this is how I should do that. Now I need to. We actually are working with a grant writer. We're trying to figure it out.
Right.
And that's, to me, is part of growing. You know, and I want to see this grow because I want to see more things, like, not just for the groups that I'm involved with, but I also want to be able, you know, if we can achieve the level of success where we can actually help bring in artists that just want to present their own music, that would be a huge thing.
Well, and also the outreach to the schools, and to the students.
Yeah.
You never know who you're going to touch.
I know.
And what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, and also the fact that you're going back and going into the archives.
Right.
You never know what you're going to find.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it, like what you did with the Metropolitan Jazz Octet, mm-hmm. and using that music. I mean, that music could still be sitting in a drawer somewhere if you wouldn't have spearheaded and just,
right.
like, decided to do something with
right.
it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how many other works are out there? So,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
I mean, this is a great cause.
It's really interesting, too, just to see what people were doing back then that, you know, that sort of, I wouldn't say the music kind of, the music existed, and then because people pass on, it stops for a little bit.
Right.
And to discover it, it's like finding a tablet and being able to, oh my gosh, this is what they were thinking back then.
Yeah.
This is how they were writing music. This is what their calligraphy looked like. I find it fascinating to be able to kind of go into their archives. And then what happens is it influences me in a way that I wouldn't have been able to get if I hadn't discovered it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of into that. It's kind
of
fun.
Oh, that's cool.
I'd like to do more of that.
You got to keep me updated on the nonprofit.
Yes.
You know, however we can help.
Sure,
and as
you
get more projects going, we can help promote that for sure.
Yeah, I'm gonna keep working at it and try to develop it.
Because you don't have anything else going on.
So yeah, nothing. Yeah, I got nothing but time.
And, of course, the new project, the Metropolitan Jazz Octet, is coming out with a new recording, D Sings Billy. That's going to be on Delmark Records.
Right.
That's coming out late summer.
Right.
So
yeah.
we'll be alert about that as
sure,
well,
absolutely.
Obviously.
Yep.
But Jim, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
I really
enjoyed
appreciate this.
That was fun.
No, it was great.
Yeah.
And of course, thanks for watching. And of course, you can see the entire issue at ChicagoJazzMagazine.com. And until next month, we will see you then.